This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
We will be doing the very best that we can for Medway, whatever the circumstances. And I think Vince and I have got a good record of working with all sorts of people, including locally when it matters. But I am not going to be persuaded to sort of support or respect policies that I think disrespect other people. And as things stand at the moment, that's how I feel about much of what Reform have got to say.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, we worked out how much a recent by-election cost the good people of Medway per vote. We look ahead at a major protest planned this weekend in Dover, and we hear what Tory leader Kemi Badenoch was doing back in the county this week. I'm Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And Dan Esson, who reports on the Borough and District Councils.
Hello.
And Nicky White, who's been looking at what's been happening at Westminster.
Hello.
And hello to you. And we'll be catching up later with Medway Council's deputy leader, Theresa Murray. First up, Robert, what's been going on in Medway this week?
This week, I've taken a look at the by-elections, which took place in February, where two Reform councillors gained their first seats on Medway Council and Labour retained a third seat. Now, this isn't my being late to the party, but actually, I have had a look at how much these votes cost versus how many people actually voted.
Okay, by-election day. So what have you found then?
Well, the total cost to run the by-elections was just over £60,000, with 13 polling places, 58 members of staff, as well as the use of Medway Park Sports Hall for the count. Of an electorate of 21,065 voters, only 4,225 actually made the effort by postal vote or heading to the polls to make their voice heard. This means the cost per vote amounts to £14.30, but if everyone who was registered had voted, the cost per vote would have been much lower at £2.80 per vote.
Did you ask why people weren't voting this by-election?
I did. I went out near to the Rochester East and Warren Wood ward, where two seats were up at the by-elections, and asked people if they voted, if they didn't, why not, and whether mandatory voting should be considered, as is in place in places like Australia. On the whole, people weren't pleased that the cost per vote was so high and definitely thought people should vote more in local elections, but equally, they basically said politicians don't help themselves. Residents told me councillors promise a lot when up for election but don't actually deliver once the voting's done. So what's the point in voting for them? While some saw the merits of compulsory voting, nearly everyone said they didn't want it introduced and the choice not to vote is as valid a political decision as voting. However, that's only so long as it is actually a decision.
Thanks very much, Robert. Dan, what have you been looking at?
So I've just been acquainting myself with the plans for a protest in Dover, which I'm going to be covering this weekend.
Okay. Immigration, I presume?
Of course. How could you tell? So some months ago, an event page was created on Facebook purporting to be for a supposedly a bikers anti-immigration and small boats demo in Dover. Whether or not it will consist mainly of bikers remains to be seen, but about 900 people say they're going on the Facebook event page, and seemingly they plan to start from near the port and then slowly march into town. Of course, there's also now a counter-protest organised by Stand Up to Racism, and the police have been in touch with both sides, trying to coordinate it with a view to preventing disorder, they say.
Do you think much will come of it?
I'm not sure. Every protest in Dover for about a decade has basically lived in the shadow of the ones in January 2016, which were pretty crazy. There were hundreds of people on each side, bricks being thrown, bits of the pavement being smashed up and that sort of thing. Eventually, over 60 people were convicted for their roles in that protest. But since then, there's not really been anything of the sort. Past couple of years, I've covered a few demonstrations in Dover that have been small but lively. But last summer, there were two planned ones which ended in pretty much nothing but small groups of counter-protesters with nothing to counter. So it could be hit or miss, could be absolute chaos, or it could be, yeah, very dull.
So Simon, what have you been working on this week?
On Monday, Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch came to Kent as part of a troop rallying exercise ahead of Kent County Council elections.
Of course we can win, but we're not going to win just by saying we're going to win. We have to work hard for it. We have to remind people about why they should vote Conservative. And that's what I'm doing right now. We can never take the electorate for granted, especially when we've had such a historic defeat as we did last year.
Well, anyway, she visited a lovely farm in the outskirts of Sevenoaks at a place called Underriver, which none of the assembled media had ever heard of, and a few still could find. But what was significant is that Mrs. Badenoch chose to go to Sevenoaks, which on paper at least is as true blue Tory as it gets. However, and there are some Tory divisions in that district which could turn out to be ones to watch, particularly for the Green Party and for the Liberal Democrats. There's also an area where the Tory leader of KCC, Roger Gough, has his division. So there may be some significance in that.
And what did she have to say?
Well, asked if the Tories could win, as you heard, she said that she could win and retain KCC at the polls on May the 1st, and that the Conservatives have done a good job on aspects of running statutory services at a big council like KCC, such as social care. And being on a farm, she spoke about the Labour farm inheritance tax, which she said is immoral and cruel, and would reverse it if she became Prime Minister. If she has a bad set of election results, as many people are predicting, if you think this should be in post long enough to fight the general election in 2029 anyway.
And what updates have you got from the campaign trail?
Well, as with every election, this is what I'm hearing at the moment, and these things can obviously change. The Tories are being buoyed that the support for reform doesn't appear as strong as it might have been, and that their own vote is not collapsing in the way that the polls seem to predict at the beginning of this campaign. And the rock-solid Tory divisions at KCC, of which they're probably about sort of between 20 and 30, may well be safe, which leaves many of the others up for grabs and possibly leaving them short of the 41 seats needed for to form the administration. The Lib Dems and the Greens are targeting seats and doing so in a big way, from what I can gather, and the Labour campaign seems a bit muted. I did ask their leader about which target seats there were in Kent, and all he said was that they were all up for grabs, which probably would be open to interpretation as them not expecting a particularly good result. Their form narrative is that they are not going to pick up enough to win KCC outright and the form of administration, but will be one of the biggest two parties in a hung council. So this might be a bit of expectation management ahead of a stunning victory or a slightly disappointing result overall, we'll have to say. Nikki, what's been keeping your MPs busy in Kent?
Well, as you said, Simon, things are hotting up. Now we're just a week away from the KCC elections, and our MPs are doing what they can to help their party secure seats. Many have been out pounding the pavements, talking to voters, or are using their social media platforms to either push their party messages or highlight the work of certain candidates while urging people who to vote for. As you mentioned earlier, this week, Tory leader Kemi Badenoch made her second visit to Kent in 6 weeks, this time to Laura Trott's constituency of Sevenoaks, declaring that, of course, the party can cling on to power at the county council elections. But with the political landscape the way it is at the moment and support growing for Reform UK, the Greens and Lib Dems, no seat is safe, and making sure you can hang on to the voters you've got is just as important as it is to attract new ones. So a trip to the Tory stronghold such as Sevenoaks was probably a really wise decision, because to see somewhere like that fall to another party would just be devastated for the Conservatives. No doubt in the coming days we'll see more big hitters visit the county as we get closer to polling day.
It'll be surprising if we don't. Well, we know of two big names that are coming from now until polling day, but we can't obviously mention them for security reasons. But anything else caught your eye?
Yes, unfortunately, Dover and Deal MP Mike Tapp had to highlight one of the downsides of taking office, and that's some of the abuse that politicians have to put up with. Unbelievably, it was all over an awful fire which happened in Dover over the weekend. 42 flats had to be evacuated when a blaze broke out at a block in Crabble Hill in Dover. It raged for several hours, and at its height, 12 fire engines were there, which gives you some idea of how serious it was. Now, Mr. Tapp is the local MP. He visited the site to see for himself how things were going, checked moves were in place to help those affected, and offered to support those who needed more help. He also thanked the emergency services for dealing with it so swiftly. Sounds harmless enough and the thing that he should be doing, but unfortunately, he accidentally called the building Crabble Mill instead of the old paper mill. It was an error, admittedly, but he described the abuse he received as a result as quite astounding. It went from rudeness all the way to death threats. He said it just showed what a cesspit parts of social media has become, and he worries for our children if this is how grown adults are conducting themselves. And he said he made no apologies for blocking anyone who took that approach on his social media accounts. It's just a stark reminder, really, to anyone standing for public office that you need a thick skin. And while any abuse is inexcusable, there's still people out there who think it's okay, but we all need to make a stand and call them out on it.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast?
Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to Kent Politics Podcast at thekmgroup.co.uk.
Our guest this week has been a councillor in Medway continuously since 2000. In fact, the anniversary of the beginning of her 25-year stint comes up next month. But much of that time was spent in opposition. That was until May 2023, when Labour took control of Medway Council and she became the authority's deputy leader and responsible for its health and adult services portfolio. Councillor Theresa Murray, welcome to the programme.
Hello, Robert. Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us a bit about yourself in terms of your background and where you come from and what actually made you get into politics in the first place.
Well, first of all, happy sober anniversary to me. I actually hadn't realised that was coming up. I come from a Labour family. So I grew up helping my dad and my uncle Doug deliver leaflets for Labour in Croydon, which was where I was born. And I came to Medway with my very young family as a young parent in 1979. And once my children were at school, I started studying and working part-time in teaching. And it's there that I got involved in trade union activity with what is now called the University and College Lecturers Union. And from that, after being a trade union activist for a long time and doing things in the community, like helping to set up a play school, helping with the campaign against the closure of the dockyard, helping with the miners' strike, I stood to be a councillor when I felt that it was appropriate for my children to need me a little bit less. So actually, I didn't stand as a councillor until my daughter had gone to university and my son was doing his A-levels. But as I say, I was a young parent, so I felt that I had plenty to offer.
And was it always an ambition to go into politics, or was it something that through your trade union work it came along that way?
It definitely evolved. I didn't have political ambitions as a younger trade union activist, but I certainly learned a lot about how politics worked, both when I was studying and when I was a trade union caseworker, when I was on the national executive. And I thought it was an important way to make a difference. And by that time, I could see that the community of Medway was in need of support, and that there were things that I felt that I could achieve through politics that perhaps would be harder to achieve if I didn't enter that particular arena.
Now, I mentioned in the intro that for the vast majority of your time serving on Medway Council, you were in opposition, which obviously is not the easiest place to be, because obviously you're watching the administrations that come and go do things that you would want to do differently. How did you keep going despite the fact that you were in that position?
I don't think I was ever rancorous in opposition. I understood the position. I was always keen on looking at the political landscape, on trying to move forward and change things. And I do believe, actually, that in opposition, there is an ability to still be a voice for the community that you represent and still try to tilt the world on its axis a little bit towards the way that you want it to go. So I wouldn't say I enjoyed being in opposition, but I did enjoy being a local councillor and a representative. Being in opposition, I did have a really big chance to get to know the people I represent and the area generally. I worked on lots of campaigns nationally. I was delighted when Labour won the government in 1997, and I played a big part in that. And of course, in between times, I sort of was a parliamentary candidate as well. So it was a time of learning, a time of lots of activity, and left me well prepared for administration. And I was working. So I was a head of faculty at Mid-Kent College. I was working in higher and further education. I enjoyed my career there enormously and got to a strong position. And all of those things came together to give me a good understanding of the community of Medway, the things that need doing, the things that we're good at. So I don't regard it as wasted time. In power, things are very, very different. And I probably underestimated, actually, just what a huge job that would be. And I'm very glad that I made the decision to make politics my full-time job in early 2023, because I think if I hadn't, I would have struggled now. But that's a commitment that I made. I was able to do it, and I'm very glad that I did.
You're the deputy leader of Medway Council, and the leader is Vince Maple, who you were, while you were in opposition, he was the opposition leader. What is your dynamic with Vince? And I mean, opposition can be a time when lots of parties, as we sort of see at the moment, can fall out. I mean, what is the dynamic and why do you work so well together?
We've worked together for 10 years as leader and deputy. We are friends. We share views and values. And actually, whilst we might on the surface appear to be very different people, we have got similar temperaments. In fact, neither of us are particularly quick to temper. We've never had a falling out ever. We're both people who listen and respect other people. And I think that's been part of it. We're also very supportive to each other. And I guess, you know, if you're very embedded in politics, your friends will be it within your political circle. It's not the only friends I've got, but I would say that my political friends are probably my dearest friends and form the majority of my social circle, apart from a couple of other special people who I've been close to for, well, the majority of my life, I guess.
Mm. Obviously, you got in charge in May 2023. When somebody asks you, what's the biggest difference you've made since Labour took control of Medway Council, what's your answer?
I think the biggest difference that we've made is to do things in a much more open, transparent and inclusive way. It was clear to me in opposition that many people in the council had no involvement at all in decision making, that people were depleted, denuded, they were lacking in resources and lacking in motivation. And we have done some very targeted things that have made a difference. For example, in adult social care, I was absolutely insistent that we needed to put back investment that was chopped out in 2019. We've brought in 80 new jobs, put that investment in. You can see and feel the difference. And because I've been a senior manager in my working life, I hope that I know how to do things. One of the nicest things that I found in my working life, and I still enjoy that enormously as a counsellor with all the kinds of people I deal with, is to see other people getting on and give them a hand up to do so. That motivates me, actually. I enjoy seeing other people realise their full potential. And there are a lot of people at Medway Council who are not doing that. So Vince and I have been very careful to say, this is the way we want to do things. We brought in external experts to scrutinise what was happening. We wanted to be assured that what we thought were based in reality and be credible. I think we've achieved that. And we have said to staff, we have got your back, but we need to know what's going on. We want to work with you. And I think that people would say in the council, they can see and feel that difference. And as such, I feel like we're getting more out of everybody to achieve the things that we want to achieve for Medway.
As I mentioned, among your responsibilities is health. What do you think is the biggest issue related to health in Medway? And what are you trying to do to change that?
I have made that my council specialism. I've been very careful to take advantage of lots of training and education to make sure that I understand the health landscape. I think the biggest difference that I've been able to make is to ensure that people who are running health services understand the perceptions and feelings of people who are recipients of those health services. And to be frank and honest about the things that we need to achieve. I'm very pleased, for example, with the way that the Health and Wellbeing Board is done. I've taken the Health and Wellbeing Strategy very, very seriously. We have a look at an element of it every time we meet. Those who come to the Health and Wellbeing Board have bought into a kind of a philosophy and a practical action that I say that we're around the table here to think about what every single one of us can do to improve and take forward the issues that we're looking at. And that seems to have worked. We've looked at women's health. We've looked at childhood obesity. We've had a really good look at safeguarding. I've invited other people to come along in the community who I think could benefit from hearing the debate. So, for example, when we discuss women's health, I had people coming along who work with women who've suffered domestic abuse, and their perspective was really valuable in getting to us to think about the objectives that we want to achieve and the way that we want to achieve them. So again, it's been a different way of doing things. And I meet very regularly with all of the health professionals and partners, apart from the formal links that Vince and I have got through the Integrated Care Board. And now with three MPs, we're very careful to feed up into the legislation that obviously that's the main job of MPs. We're the deliverers, they're the legislators, the things that are going on and the difference that we could make in Medway. So we've got the new health centre coming on stream. We work very hard to push on that. We've got the diagnostic centre coming in Rochester, actually in my ward. I'm very pleased with that. There have been hiccups along the way with electrical services and other things, but it'll be fully open later on this year. And we're really pressing hard to get an elective surgery centre in Medway to help the hospital clear their site, put health services closer to people in the wider community. And there's work going on to try and make that happen. So I believe in the government's policy to bring health closer to the community. And I'm doing everything, I think, to play my part in making sure that that happens. That does not mean everything's perfect. I absolutely accept that things are not. After all of those years of austerity, there's a long way to go. But I can see consistent improvements. And I meet regularly with the GPs in my ward and others from other areas. And I'm always interested to hear their perspective on changes in policy and try and weave that into the things that are happening.
Mm. Just on GPs, actually, GPs are always a sort of a big talking point, and lots of people talk about getting appointments and these sorts of things. And the government has announced that 26 new GPs are coming to Kent and Medway. Do you think that's enough? I mean, we've been looking at sort of the ratios of doctors to patients, and the Medway primary care networks have the lowest GP to patient ratio in the county, with one practice having over 16,000 registered patients for just one doctor.
Yes, I think we've got one of the lowest GP to patient ratios in the country, which is completely unacceptable. And that has happened over a long period of time. When I first started working in the health portfolio in opposition, Medway had, most unusually actually, a lot of small, single-handed GPs, many of whom retired at the same time. So even before demand started rising in the way that it has done in the last 5 or 10 years, there was a landscape that was very fragile in Medway, and not enough attention was paid to that to strengthen it and make it resilient to face the challenges of the future. So that has been a very deep-seated, long-standing problem. What is happening now is that practices are starting to work together. That is welcome. There is recognition in the GP community, because after all, they are private businesses, remember, commissioned by the NHS. There's recognition that younger GPs, and particularly women, don't always want to be a partner with a mortgage responsibility for a building. They actually want to be salaried. And I think there's a need over time to change the contracts and make those opportunities more available so we don't have so many locums. I understand people's need to have a relationship with somebody in a GP surgery, that they can recognise who they feel knows them. That is much harder to achieve as things stand now. But I do think GPs have done well to embrace having different practitioners working around them. GPs in my area have told me something very surprising, that demand in one of the practices for appointments for mental health for people between the age of 25 and 45 is outstripping demand for appointments from people over 65 for any condition. Now, that is completely new. Even 2 or 3 years ago, that wouldn't have been heard of. So for me, we've got to delve deeply and collectively into what is it that is causing mental health problems to overwhelm GP surgeries, who, after all, are not mental health specialists, with that particular group of people. Why are they despairing, some of them? Why are they finding that they need mental health help? What else can we do to change things and to make those people feel that they are supported? So, you know, some of the issues are causal. There has been a cost of living crisis. It's still going on despite, you know, our best efforts to try to change that. The progress is slow. You know, is it that that's happening? Are there other reasons? And I have said very clearly and very, you know, that we've got to work together to find out why that is. So GPs are responding to the way that people are responding to the things that are happening to them in the wider community and society as a whole. And that has changed the demand they have on appointments and actually the way they have to deal with people. And unless you talk to people and find out about that, then you can carry on going, oh, there aren't enough GP appointments, but finding out what the reasons are. And I think they're actually different from area to area and even from ward to ward, actually, is an important part of the work we need to do.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, you took over in May 2023. Then a little over a year later, we had a general election, and as people may have heard, and Keir Starmer is now in number 10. How do you feel the new government is doing?
I think that the new government is doing fine, actually. Every single thing they do isn't something that I think is amazing, but given the mess that they inherited, and Keir's, I voted for him as leader, and one of the reasons I did that because he knows how to run a big organisation and has really got to grips with the Labour Party before coming into government and now getting to grips with government. There are lots and lots of things to do. I think that we perhaps need to communicate better on the programme of things that are happening. But if I think of the things that have happened, positive changes to employment conditions, a real focus on green energy, a determination to right the wrongs in the health service, which we've just talked about, they are things that matter to ordinary people every single day. We're yet to get to grips with bringing the cost of living down to a copeable level after the terrible crisis that Liz Truss's budget caused. But we're on the way there, and I'm pleased with the kind of determination and sort of strong attitude that has been taken towards managing the economy. However, events come along and blindside people. You know, who knew how catastrophic some of the decisions that Donald Trump has made in just over 100 days would be for the world? The world feels very unstable. That's completely different to when Labour came into government in 1997. Both the economy and the world were in a much more stable state. So, you know, there are challenges that were not expected. And look, a lot of people who are learning their craft, learning their trade. Lots of those new Labour MPs were councillors before, and you can afford to be a lot more hands-on when you're a councillor. When you're a backbench MP, it's a very different proposition. So they're having to learn and accommodate what they're doing. What I'm really grateful for is the good relationships we've got with our three MPs. Vince and I meet them every month. We share things. We invite them to things. We talk things through. And that's how things should work. And I'm optimistic that that will yield good things for Medway.
And so do you think that, you'll know this, and I do as well, that, say, full council meetings, some issues come up as motions, and I remember around the winter fuel allowance was one that the Tory opposition put against the Labour administration, trying to sort of stoke a bit of division between yourselves and the government. I mean, do you think it's a case of the government needs to sort of understand how the decisions they make are going to play out in the wider public and how to manage how people feel about these things?
Well, that's our job to work with MPs to tell them. And Robert, you'll know this week, I'm going to bring a motion about the proposals in the Green Paper. I'm doing that not as an attack on disabled and sick people, but as an opportunity to right some wrongs, to look at a broken system, to think about how we can make the welfare system work better. And I'm using that opportunity to have a debate. The Tories can do the job of opposition in trying to divide us. Actually, we are very united. We support our government. And we're not doing that in a sort of fawning, sycophantic way. We're doing that on the basis of practical policy. So the motion I'm bringing on Thursday is an opportunity for us to have a look at that and then feed up. You know, it's been wrong for a million years that disabled people can't use their bus pass before 9 o'clock in the morning. That's one of the things that stops disabled people working. I was at one of the disability groups' AGM just a couple of weeks ago, and I'll be sharing this in full council because it's a story worth repeating. And a guy there who had multiple sclerosis said, look, I think PIP does need changing. Personal independence payment does need changing. As things stand at the moment, I'm forced to give the worst view of myself. He said, some days my legs don't work and I really need the money that PIP gives me to get a taxi. Other days they do, but I'm not permitted if I want to keep that money that keeps me going and allows me actually to get to work. I'm not permitted to tell anyone the best view of myself. And, you know, that really struck me, Robert. I thought, blimey, that, you know, we none of us want to give the worst view of ourselves to anybody. But people in receipt of personal independence payment are forced to do that if they want to make sure that they get it, because the system and the assessments are not working properly and not taking account of what it's like to have that kind of condition. So I'm optimistic that the consultation and the green paper process will be able to correct some of those things, as much as it will be able to look at efficiencies and think about how we're going to get some people who could work back to work.
Next month, we're looking at the KCC elections. Are you optimistic for those results? Do you think that Labour will do well? I mean, the Tories are predicted to not do very well, but Reformer are also predicted to do quite well. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I've had a sharp shock in my ward, haven't I, Robert, by getting Reform councillors elected and only losing by 21 votes. I could see that they were campaigning. I could see they were building on the kind of disgruntlement. They certainly weren't campaigning on any local policies or ideas. And I think Reform are getting a bit of a free pass generally, capitalising on, as I say, people being a bit understandably fed up, not really offering any solutions, shouting about everybody else and pursuing things that I fundamentally am absolutely opposed to, that is blaming immigrants for all sorts of wrongs and being pretty mean to lots of other marginalised groups. So Labour have never been hugely strong on KCC, although we've always had a consistent presence. I've been working in Snodland to that. There's a by-election there on the town council and obviously a divisional seat. Received a reasonably good response in an area that hasn't particularly been Labour, and certainly not heard loads of criticism of the government. But I wait to see the history of Reform, because of course they're UKIP, and before that, whatever they were under James Goldsmith, is that when they get into power, they cause absolute chaos. We've seen examples of that on Thanet Council in Kent and elsewhere in the country. But I respect people's right to make a democratic choice, and we will work alongside whoever we have to work alongside, because we've got local government reform on the horizon. So we'll see.
Obviously, there are elements that KCC and Medway work together on. Will it be difficult if Reform are in charge?
Well, I've never worked with Reform in any serious way or heard of them working in any serious way either. So that's to be tested. But we will be doing the very best that we can for Medway, whatever the circumstances. And I think Vince and I have got a good record of working with all sorts of people, including locally when it matters. But I am not going to be persuaded to sort of support or respect policies that I think disrespect other people. And as things stand at the moment, that's how I feel about much of what Reform have got to say.
Theresa Murray, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Robert. Nice to talk to you.
Next week's Kent County Council election will attract turnouts of probably no more than 35%, and in some cases considerably less. Given how important these elections are to people's lives, it's a wonder more people won't struggle down to the polling station. After all, the turnout for a general election is probably about twice that. Rob, what is stopping people going out and voting when it comes to the local elections?
Well, as I mentioned in sort of my main bit earlier, I think lots of the things that people said is that they don't really have faith in their local, these are council politicians, to actually do what they say they're going to do. Now, whether that's a fair criticism to be levelled, I mean, a lot of councillors might say, well, certain things are outside of our bounds of power, but still, that lack of faith is a real reason keeping people away. I think also the lack of profile for local politicians. You know, when there's a general election, we all know about it. We all know, well, most of us know who the Prime Minister is and who sort of key politicians are. But do we all know who the ward member for our council is? I'm not sure that all of us do. To be honest, sometimes I have to go and check who specifically my ward member is and things like that.
I'm not sure people know who their MP is.
Yeah, I mean, but at least they know when they are going to vote.
Yeah.
I think another problem with council elections is that they can be so variable. So we're having elections here in Kent, but other areas of the country are also having elections and some aren't. So if you're not super switched on to local politics and you hear there are some local council elections, you may not be certain if your area is included within that.
And I suppose people don't always know the difference between a borough and a district and the counties or their parish or town council. So it's a bit confusing. So, I mean, are you making that argument perhaps to sort of have them all at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a variety of different systems where they have sort of rotational council elections where a third of the council will be. I think it's all just too confusing. I think a much simpler and much more straightforward way would be to have all council elections across the country all on one day, much like we have a general election. It doesn't have to be on the same day, it could just be the local election day. And this would, I think, at least simplify it so people know, you know, the targeted advertising of getting people out to vote could say, this is the day you need to be aware that you can go and vote. And I think, you know, you'll still see people who are apathetic and think there's no point, but I think at least there won't be the excuse that they weren't aware.
Nikki, do you agree with that?
I think it's a brilliant idea. It's not something that dawned on me before we started chatting about this beforehand. I think it's something that needs to get fixed in people's mindset. I mean, it baffles me why more people don't vote. And if you don't vote, then don't complain if things don't go your way. Yeah. But people seem to. I mean, when I was young, my parents weren't particularly politically involved or engaged, but they did go out and vote, and they made it clear to us as kids, not through any enforcement or anything, but, you know, how important it was for you to take that vote. You know, we on polling day, we would walk to the polling station as a family. We'd sit outside where mum and dad went in and voted and then come away again. It was not a family trip out, but it just became part of a natural thing that we did as a family. And when I turned 18, I couldn't wait to get in the ballot box. It was like a rite of passage, but maybe I've led a bit of a sheltered life. I don't know. But I'd also like the idea of telling people that they have to vote, making it compulsory, but giving them the option of being able to register the fact that they don't want to vote for anybody in particular. So you are saying, I acknowledge the political process and I acknowledge the voting process, I just don't wish to vote for anybody on that particular occasion. But,
Dan, there's a sort of similar model in Australia. Does it work there?
Yeah, well, so you in Australia, if you're registered to vote, you're expected to go and vote, and it gets backed up by a fine. I think it varies from state to state, but it's a pretty trivial fine. It's like $20 or something like that. It's enough to make it an inconvenience, and they end up with extraordinarily high turnout, funnily enough.
So what?
Like, I'm above 90%
regularly. That's what I was saying. Oh, yeah.
One of my best friends is Australian. He's lived in Australia for a couple general election seasons, and he thinks it works quite well. He says that normal people feel significantly more engaged in politics. He says, you know, you go to the polling station and you see people having barbecues outside and that kind of thing. And he said it contributes to a, in a small way, but to a more lively political culture. They still have the same problems that we have here in that, you know, political parties are, in an objective sense, more a part of the state than they are a part of society, and that voters have sort of withdrawn and away from politics. But it definitely helps that people are at least expected to take an interest. So I was, for a long time, instinctively queasy about the idea of compulsory voting because it's an imposition on your liberty. And I'm of the opinion if your political culture can't compel you, can't make you vote out of interest, that's a sign of a failing political culture, which it definitely is. But I think it's a relatively small imposition on people for quite a massive benefit. And if you don't want to vote, I'd encourage everyone, you know, spoil your ballot. If everyone who didn't vote or who chose not to vote or who avoided voting or just didn't care wrote something on their ballot paper to indicate their lack of interest or lack of support, the message that would send would be gigantic compared to simply not turning up.
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Rob, Nikki and Dan for their contributions. And don't forget to keep an eye on KentOnline.com/politics for the latest news from around the county. You can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.